Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank Professor Yadid for the opportunity to speak here today, and I also like to thank everyone for coming, because I could be doing something else. So what I'm going to talk about today is work for my, it's going to be my PhD thesis with Professor Davidson. And here I'm going to present a simple case with two isometries. So let's say we just want to study two isometries, and in particular the Cicero algebra that they generate. And I'm going to assume that the isometries are non-unitary. So I've just enumerated here a couple of cases that people have studied or you can study. The first one is you assume that V star W is zero. So that implies that the ranges are going to be orthogonal, and there's two different cases, whether you get, if you sum them, whether you get I or less than I. And when you get I, again, the Kutz algebra. And what I'd like to mention is that you can represent the Kutz algebra on semigroup, the free semigroup on two generators, so all the words in x1 and x2, where the first isometry is going to be multiplying by x1 and the second isometry is going to multiply by x2. Is that clear enough? Can you see that? So it's unique and you can represent it that way. So second case would be that you just assume that V star and W commute, and then also assume that the ranges commute. So the ranges can overlap. So if you assume this, you can actually prove, it's very easy, that not only W commutes with V star, but it also commutes with V. And so what you get is that the Cicero algebra generated by the two isometries will be just isomorphic to S tensor I and I tensor S. So you do the Wall decomposition on V, let's assume that V is a pure isometry. So you get S is the, I'm just going to get, so S is going to be the unilateral shift, and you've got multiplicity of V embedded into I. And the point of this is that if W commutes with V and V star, then it's going to commute with these projections. And so these projections, these spaces are going to reduce W. And therefore you can represent this case in the same way as I did with the Kutz algebra. No, it's just different thing you can study. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that only as in you don't assume that it's zero. What?
In first case,
well, that's the best I can do. And you can represent that case on little L2 of Z plus cross Z plus, and these spaces are going to be, you can look at those as the vertical strands, and V is going to be shifting to the right, and W would shift up. Another case you could study is simply assume that V and W commute, and don't assume anything on the stars or the ranges. And Berger, Coburn, and Liebau showed that you can reduce this to studying by a tensor decomposition that they have. You can reduce this to studying a unitary and a projection, but basically, in their paper, C star of UP is not really simpler than the C star algebra of V and W. So you have to assume a little bit more if you want to say something meaningful, let's say, on the C star algebra. And the first two cases, what my point is that they assume too much. They reduce to one case. And what I'd like to have is basically assumptions which are going to give me a variety of cases that are interesting. So what I'm going to do is assume that the two isometries satisfy that star condition. So I'm going to assume that the range projections from a commutative set, like all the powers of V and N, or V and W, and I'm going to assume that V and W commute within a constant, like the rational rotation algebra when you have unitaries, and a technical hypothesis that's going to come back. Here, basically, I'm simplifying the notation, just using the notation like with two isometries. but that's a semigroup representation. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. And with semigroup representations, the technical hypothesis becomes clear. And there's a variety of examples of this phenomenon, so of two isometries that satisfy that. So take a subset of Z2, and I'm going to call subsets of Z2 modules when they're invariant under adding all the positive vectors. So if you add any vector in Z2 plus, you stay in M. So if you have such a subset M, such a module, you can define two isometries on it just by essentially what I did in case 2. V is going to be a shift to the right and W a shift up. And you twist V in such a way that you actually do get VW is alpha WV. Coefficients really easy. And given such a module, we're going to call the feature algebra of the module with respect to alpha, the feature algebra written by the two isometries. And the fact that the range projections commute is also easy to check. So the main term I'm going to talk about is the following. If you have two isometries satisfying the star conditions, then there is a module M that you can construct so that the C-star algebra of V and W is isomorphic to C-star algebra of the C on M with that alpha. And a special case of this was proved in the 80s by Hector Salas, who proved this with alpha is 1, and he used a group boy linking the two C-star algebras and use group boy theory to do it. So what I'm going to do is basically do the case when alpha is not 1. And also, the construction that I have in my thesis constructs M fairly explicitly. And also, I'll try to give you an intuition of how the operators get their norm, and that's how I did the, that's how I proved it. No, no. Yeah, it's going to be the ideal of the...
But the assumption, there's some kind of technical hypothesis.
What's that?
That's kind of what I'm not too
intense. Okay. So first I'm going to do a study what happens on modules and see what happens there. So one way to study modules is to look at the local, what happens locally. So I'm going to call a diamond of radius n around a point P the set of points Q in the module, which are a distance n from P. And two diamonds are going to be called equivalent if they basically are just a translate of the other. And obviously, if two diamonds are translate of the other, they have the same, they look the same, they have the same shape. And so this defines an equivalence relation, and we call an equivalence class an abstract diamond. That's going to be just a shape. I have a couple of easy examples here. Maybe you'd like to see them. So here are two examples of modules, and this is an old slide, but V1 and V2, but it doesn't matter. And so the big dots are the points in the module, and A and B, I haven't defined them yet, but the diamond of radius 1 around 1, 1 in the module M1 is these points. And the important thing is that the shape looks like this, and you don't have this point here. The corner is removed.
So M1 is the first corner with the first thing removed, the origin.
Is the 0, 0 removed, yeah. And M2, well, is just... Yeah. Let me leave that here. So these diamonds, what it contains, they contain the local information as to what happens on the module, about the geometry and everything. And what you can do is you want to look at different modules globally, and we're going to say that module M1 is locally representable in M2 if every diamond of M1 occurs also in M2. And similarly, there's an equivalence relation, so two modules are going to be locally equivalent if they have the same diamonds.
Does it have one of
person is. So when I want to find, say, M1, or rather that diamond that you showed, M1.
Sure, yeah. Right, exactly. So that's why I maybe blew this diagram last night. But M1 is contained, locally contained in M2 because, right, that corner here, in fact, happens infinitely many often. But if you take a bigger, let's say you take...
Yeah, okay, that's what I'm going to worry about. So I take a bigger one.
Right, take a bigger one. And what happened here is that I constructed M2. Let me... I built my printer, so maybe I can use that. So I constructed M2 so that, for example, if you take this one here, then it occurs over here. And then that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah,
right.
So, and you're not allowed to stick this one, for example, if I take the diamond about the point 2.2, you're not allowed to stick that up around so that the corner goes at P1 because there's something below there.
Right, well, yeah, so this means that you can find it somewhere. So if you take the
A diamond.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And M2 doesn't go into M1, of course, that's pretty obvious because it's just too complicated. What was here? And one thing that you can show is that this local equivalence is pretty useful because it basically determines when the two C's algebras are going to be isomorphic or not. With sending the generators to the generators, that's always the isomorphisms I'm going to look at. So if you take pi sending v to v and w to w, that's going to extend to star isomorphism. There's the word extend missing here. If and only if M1 and M2 are locally equivalent and alpha is beta. So that's one way to classify modules, is to look at what's the C star algebra going to generate. And another way to classify them is to separate them into three families, doing what I'm going to do here. So the points, the boundaries, just the points on the left, right? The points that don't have anything like -1, 1, might take -1, -1 in both coordinates. If that's not in the module, the point's in the boundary. So a point in the boundary of M, we're going to say it has infinite multiplicity. If for every N, there exists another point in the boundary for which the two diamonds are equivalent or the same. And otherwise, we're going to say it has finite multiplicity. And this is pretty easy to show, well, to see even. If a point has infinite multiplicity, then in fact there are infinitely many points for which, so if you fix an N, there's infinitely many Qs for which the two diamonds around Q and P are going to be the same. And the idea to see this is simply that if you have your point P, you have a diamond around a size N. And by definition, you get a Q for which the diamond of size N around Q is the same. But then what you do is just take a bigger N, which contains the 2, and you know there's going to be another Q for that N. So maybe it's kind of a hand-waving argument, but you just have to think about it. So you've got a point P, and you've got a point Q. So this is for size, this size. So what you do is you take a size which is that big. So what that means is this whole thing is going to be repeated somewhere else. And so this is going to be repeated here somehow, somewhere. And so doing that for bigger and bigger n's, you get infinitely many points. And so what that means is if one point has infinite multiplicity, all points are going to have infinite multiplicity. So that's one way to distinguish modules. Another way, which is easier in a way, is the notion of periodicity. So a module is going to be called periodic if you can translate it and it's the same module, just like rational numbers. And the importance of periodicity is the following. If it's periodic, it's periodic and only if the C-star algebra is irreducible, or not periodic, yeah. And that gives us three families. So one family is family C, where the module is periodic. And when C star algebra is irreducible, what you can get is infinite multiplicity or finite multiplicity. Yeah. Yeah, you can actually see, get something in the commutator. The translation is you integrating the commutator. Yeah. And what I'd like to do is use this to give an intuition, well, that's what I did with the proof anyway, give some sort of intuition as to how I can prove the existence of the M and the isomorphism that I claim exists. So the first step is to define a maximum abelian subalgebra of C star of V.
What? So the theorem, would that statement still be true without using the word pi here? Because the two algebras are pi modulus only. And they don't divide by pi.
I'm not quite sure, to be honest. That's a whole different question there. Yeah. No, I don't distinguish them yet. Actually, that's a natural question. Which is defined that way. So that's in the diagonal algebra. I'm going to call it the diagonal algebra. And with two isometries, that's the part that doesn't look too good with two isometries. It looks better with a semigroup representation. But basically what you do is you want to look at all the monomials in V, W, V star, W star. And what you can say is that those are all partial isometries. And you take the projections onto their initial and final ranges or projections. And I guess what this says is that instead of considering all monomials, it's enough to consider only those. And so a bit of a more intuitive way to see this is you have your hypothetical module. It doesn't exist yet, but if you have it, then you'd want to have any translation by any vector. So V star N, W M is translation by minus N M, and so on. And you want to have all these projections. And the point of taking this is that it contains enough information, that in fact contains all local information that one will need to actually construct M. And how do you do that? So that's the following definition. So what you do is you look at diamonds. That you don't, well, you take a shape, like a diamond, an abstract one. And what you'd like to do is say this. If you look at a module, you take a vector EQ in the orthonormal basis, it's got properties from the geometry of the diamond around it. So if you take something like, let me just make a picture that's actually, if you take this, then you know it's in the range of V, in the range of W, but not in the range of VW. So what you can do is for every abstract diamond, you can define from its shape a projection which you hope that the vectors in it will have some of the good properties of these EQs. So that's how we define it. So that you look at the central point here, and you want to know, well, you want to take a projection on the range of V, W star, V, but not VW, and so on. And step two is actually constructing M so that if you have a module M for which the C star algebras are isomorphic, then the diagonal algebras are going to be isomorphic, and you want to construct M so that its diagonal algebra, the diagonal algebra of C star M, is the same as the one that you have on A, where A is the C star algebra of V and W. And you have to be a bit careful here because you can't take just arbitrary diamonds, because the diamonds here, you could just go to infinity. And so you have to take an increasing sequence of patterns of diamonds, which sort of sticks. Anyway, it's a bit hand waving again, but you have to be careful. So once you have constructed M, then you can hope that A and C star M are going to be isomorphic. So the rho here is not defined in step 3. So in step 3, what you do is you construct expectations from C star M onto its diagonal algebra. And just for the sake of making it into 45 minutes, there's sort of an expectation from A to its diagonal algebra, even though that's not true. That comes from the result. So what you have to do is go to the universal algebra, but let's just say we have this. And the point of this diagram is that if you can construct rho, which is just a star representation, then that's going to be enough. It's going to be faithful because the two expectations are faithful. So if something in A positive is sent to 0, it's sent to 0 going the other way, and so it has to be 0. So the point, or the hard part of all this, is actually to construct, well, not construct, but prove that rho is a representation, so you have to show your norm inequality that you need. So rho here is just going to be the one, the map, I think I called it pi earlier, anyway, that sends V to V and W to W. And I have 20 minutes left. Well, the problem here is that these projections that I've defined over there, they look in theory better than they really are in practice because the vectors in them are not wandering. That's easier to show an example and just explain it. So if you look in M1, the pattern, the diamond D that's over here, you have one point. In M2, you have infinitely many points in it, infinitely many infinite-dimensional space. And if you look at M1, E11 is wandering for all the powers of V1 and V2 or VW. But if you look in M2, so in general, that it's not wandering. If you take the sum of E, P1, and P2, then you can just go take W V star, and EP2 is going to be EP1, and so it's not, you don't get zero. And basically what that says is that the norm estimate isn't going to be as easy as you'd like it to be. So the answer to this is here. So the answer is, like I said here, quickly, is to take diamonds for which you can take diamonds that are so big that it's going to be the vectors in it are going to be wandering for just very small monomials, and taking bigger and bigger and bigger diamonds so that the vectors in them are going to be wandering for more and more monomials, and eventually you get enough that you can get a good norm estimate. Anyway, it's technical, obviously. Okay, so I also had classification of modules into three families, and you can also do that in general. So one of my hypotheses was that, well, the theorem works only for irreducible feature algebras, so C won't be there because that was the periodic ones which were reducible. And families A and B, you can see them in the following way. So you take a sequence of diamonds getting bigger and bigger so that they all contain one another, and that gives us projections that are decreasing. And there's a little proposition here that says that if the range projections of all these diamonds have dimension greater than 2 for every I, then in fact they all have infinite dimension. And it's kind of the little argument I said here. The definition of infinite multiplicity is kind of like you need just one other, but in reality you have infinitely many other. So this proposition generalizes the little remark that I had. And the consequence of this is that we have two cases that can happen. So it's irreducible. So if one of the projections has dimension 1, then you're going to get the compacts, and you get only one representation, one faithful representation. And a bit more interesting case is when the dimensions are all infinite. And in that case, you can actually prove that from here that because you, from the proof of the norm inequality over there, you can actually strengthen this and get that the right-hand side is for the essential norm, because what happens is that the norm on the right over there actually occurs on infinite-dimensional space. And another consequence of this is that all the faithful representations are going to be approximately entirely equivalent, faithful on the diagonal. Okay, so you can set this up in a similar way for abelian semigroups. So you've seen these definitions this morning of these definitions of cocycle. So you take a cocycle, theta, on a semigroup, and you're going to require the semigroup to be, for this talk anyway, abelian, countable, and cancellative. And an isometric theta representation or isometric projective representation is a map taking elements of S to isometries on some V of H, satisfying this condition. So you can join Vx, Vy to get theta xy, Vx plus y. And this is exactly, well, this the case that I just had before with two isometries, a special case of this, where you take that representation. So, what can you say for more general abelian groups, basically? So I'm taking S cancellative because I want to embed it into a group, because that's what I was doing earlier, right? To have two isometries, they're a representation of Z2 plus. And what I did is construct a module in Z2. So I need to have access to a group embedding a semigroup. So I'm going to need cancellation there. And just like the other definition, I'm going to call a subset of G an S module if it's invariant on their action by S, just adding elements of S. And a little bit of a remark here. The cocycle is defined on S originally. But if you want to define the representation on the module, you're going to need theta to be defined on the whole group, or at least on the whole module. And Latta and Rayburn proved that you can extend all two cocycles actually from a normal subsemigroup to the entire group. So we just fix an extension, and we're going to work with an extension of a two cocycle on the whole group. And just like we had before, you can define isometries on the module by the following formula. So delta A is going to be mapped to delta SA and twisted by the two cocycle. And this generalizes what's called the Wiener-Hopf representation, where instead of having this on L2 of M, you have this on L2 of S. And what I've been able to prove is basically a similar result. So taking a abelian countable group and a semigroup contained in it, which is generating, so it generates the entire S and doesn't contain any invariable elements. You fix the two cocycle in the whole group and an isometric theta representation, and you need three hypotheses which are essentially the same that I had for the case of two isometries. So I'm going to require it to be irreducible, and I'm going to require the range projections to commute, and this is the technical assumption that I didn't give. And now it's much easier to give. So if S is different than T, that operator VS star VT is not unitary. And also this is a pretty strong condition. All right. That's the next one. Yeah. So, the actual conclusion of the theorem is that there exists a module so that the map sending generators to generators extends to star isomorphism. And I already gave you a bit of the technical side of the proof, so I'm not going to do that another time. But what I'm going to do is just give you an example. So the example I had was Z2 plus, and you could take, just for example, S to be the positive integers 0, 2, 3, 4, etc. And just for simplicity, you can assume that the cocycle is trivial. It's always 1. And basically, one of the main differences between these two semigroups is the order you get on the group. So on every every time you have an abelian semigroup in an abelian group, or non-abelian, doesn't matter, you define, the semigroup defines a partial order on G. So an element G is less than H, the G inverse H is an S, so S are the positive elements of the group. And the point is that the partial order you get on Z2 and Z are going to be quite different from these two semigroups. And the main difference is that Z2 plus induces a lattice structure on Z2. And by that I mean the following. So if you take any two vectors in Z2, you can define a join and a meet or an inf and a sup or whatever you want to call them. Let's call them lowest upper bound. So if you take a vector n here, then what I want is the lowest upper bound of this one and that one, so it will be this. And also I want the lowest upper bound in S. So it's this vector. And this exists in Z2, it's clear. So we can do that also for one vector, and you can basically project that vector n here onto n plus. So n plus is going to be defined as infimum over all the positive elements, so S has to be positive, so it has to be in Z2 plus, n greater than n, and you get, visually you get this, and of course there's a very easy formula, you just get that n plus is really n1 plus, n2 plus, the positive parts of the vector. And you can define n to be the difference between n plus and n minus. And what you get is that you can decompose n into n plus and n minus, and in a unique way. And you can define an isometry, a partial isometry, Wn, which is going to be Vn minus star and Vn plus. And the real question is, well, there's two questions here. First question is, why would you do this? Why is it important? And the second question is, can you do this in general for any group within an abelian semigroup? So the importance is the following. So you're going to get partial isometries which satisfy the following. If you take the injection of L2 of M in L2, so the M sits inside Z2. So if you take L2 of M inside L2 of Z2, then these WNs are just a cut up the corner of the left regular representation. And you can calculate that. It's pretty easy to calculate. And that's basically why they're so important. And in fact, if you want to study the C-star algebra generated by VS, by VSs for S in Z2 plus, what you actually study is products of VSs and VSs stars, and you can just study VNs like that, because VNs, arbitrary products of VNs, that is closed under star and product. Just because I was too lazy to write bars on top of everything. Yeah. When you have indices, they're numbers. Otherwise, they're vectors. How much time do I have? 10 minutes. Okay. So one thing that maybe I forgot to mention this. So what happens here is that what I'd like to show you is that these WNs are well defined. Obviously they were defined because I defined them in a unique way. But my point is this. So if you take, so you have your vector n, and you could write your vector n as s minus t, where s and t are both positive vectors. And the question is, if you take v of the negative part, so this will be the negative part. So if you take v t star, v s, what do you get? You're going to get the same w n. You should, if it is to make sense, right? And so what happens here? So if we, what the equations you have are n is going to be s minus t, and that's going to be n plus minus n minus. So, and in fact, because the n plus and n minus, the n plus is defined with that infimum that you can't see on top there. Well, you can just rearrange this, first of all, to get s plus n minus is n plus plus t. But also, what you're going to have is that s is going to be greater than n plus, and t is going to be greater than n minus. So n plus is defined as the smallest element, which was bigger than n. So if you take another one, that s would have to be bigger than n plus. And I just ran out of space. All right, so let's say we want to calculate VT star VS. So that's going to be, T is going to be, let's say, say T minus N minus plus N minus times V, and for S I'm going to take S minus N plus plus N plus. And the point of these two equations is that this is a positive vector, so you can split it up. So you get V n minus star V T minus n minus star V S minus n plus V n plus. And then you can cancel these two because T minus n minus, I did this wrong, but you put this one on that side and this one on this side, and these two vectors are actually equal. This is an isometry, so they cancel out, and you get that this is just Wn, like the usual definition. So I guess the point here is that it seems as though you're going to need some sort of lattice structure, some sort of infimum, to be able to decompose every element of the group in terms of a positive part and a negative part to be able to make calculations with that. Sorry, what?
Well,
scattering over?
Anyway, you have some, I hope you have an in and out.
I don't know. Sorry. So what happens on S? Well, you don't have a lattice structure like this. So let's say you want to take 1, so 1 can be, well, it's in Z. And let's say you want to decompose 1 into a sum of a positive and negative part. Well, the infimum over there, so the infimum of all the elements of S which are bigger than 1 and in S doesn't exist, because all the elements which are bigger than 1, well, they have to be at least 2 plus 1. Like 1 plus 2, 1 plus 3, 1 plus 4, because the difference has to be in S, and the difference starts at 2. S is 0, 2, 3, 4, and etc. So you get that a set of elements which are bigger than 1 is 3, 4, 5, and so on, and 3 and 4 are not comparable themselves. So this infimum doesn't exist. And the proposition here, to be simple, is that, in fact, what you can do to define a partial isometry of 1 is just use this proposition. So proposition just says that if you're a little bit more clever in that calculation, what it can show is that if you separate G into minus S plus T or minus V plus G plus V, where S T U V are all positive, then in fact V S star V T V U star V V are actually going to be equal, and you can define V of G to be that. And the proof is actually simpler than that. So here inside, you just stick in the VU, you rejoin these two, so you get VU plus S star, VU plus T, And just from the equation, you get u plus t is s plus v. So what you get is that this becomes s plus v. And here I'm using that it's abelian. This doesn't work when it's not abelian. And you get vu star and vv. And there you go. So basically, that shows that most of the things that you can do on Z2 or Zm, you can actually do them for abelian, for abelian groups. I thought we have time to talk about non-abelian groups, but I wasn't planning to anyway. But this breaks down, for example. So, but you can do something. You can actually say something intelligent, even when it's not abelian. But that's a bit more complicated. Thank you.